So welcome everybody. I think tomorrow's the first day of spring, and it feels like the first day of spring tomorrow, doesn't it? It's pouring rain here, and it's cold, but it's actually going to be the first day of summer. So let's begin by cultivating our motivation. And as we reflected and learned last week, we have taken this body due to ignorance, afflictions, polluted karma. And so we're carrying around this bag of filth, this sack with bones and pus and blood and all sorts of icky kinds of things in it. And our mind is so out of touch with reality that we're attached to this bag of stuff, thinking it's I, thinking it's mine, not wanting to separate from it. And so being constantly involved in thinking about how to give this body pleasure, protect it from harm, and in the process of doing that, creating a lot of negative actions, harming other people who threaten this body, stealing their stuff in order to sustain this body, having unwise and unkind sexual relationships to give this body pleasure, lying to get things for this body, and so on and so forth. Now, so much of our degenerate ethical conduct, it comes from attachment to this body. And so let's generate an aspiration to release this attachment, and then use all that energy that until now we've been using to be attached to this body. Let's take all that energy and put it into generating bodhicitta, and then acting with bodhicitta, and really making our lives meaningful by working for the benefit of all living beings. So let's generate the aspiration to do that, and even imagine being able to do that. And let that be our motivation for sharing the Dharma together this evening. When we talk about this body as a bag of filth, people often recoil. And go, "Wow, how dare you talk about this body that way? You know, the body is beautiful, and you know, it's this magical thing that, you know, is like the best machine that can ever work, except for the fact that it breaks down all the time." And we really don't like to hear that, and we'll fight, you know, to really push forth this notion of how wonderful the body is. And yet, you know, we still expect to be able to realize the emptiness of inherent existence when we're adverse to actually admitting on a conventional level what this body is. So what I'm saying is, like, the ignorance that's grasping at inherent existence is so much deeper, is so much more difficult to get rid of than this ignorance that thinks the body is pleasurable and the body is beautiful and clean and so on. And yet we have so much resistance to thinking, you know, that way about the body. Okay? So we have to, you know, really kind of put first things first. And that's why we meditate on impermanence first. And through impermanence, we see that, you know, all the things that are impermanent, that come into being due to afflictions and karma, are in the nature of dukkha, you know, and they're unclean. And because they're in the nature of dukkha, yeah, then there's not something to hang on to. And when we investigate them further, we see that there's no self in them, and, you know, they aren't possessed by any kind of solid self either. Okay, so those four things of, you know, impermanence and foulness or uncleanness and the nature of dukkha and selfless, they all kind of go together and apply to the body in particular, as well as to many other things. Okay? And so it's by slowly gaining these kinds of understandings that we put our mind more and more in line with reality. Yeah, to the point where then we will be able to realize emptiness and free our mind from all this kind of attachment, clinging and craving. And yet, you know, until we get to that point where we really think, you know, there's nothing good in here, there's nothing to be attached to, then there's going to be always some stickiness for our samsara. You know, and then our mind is, let me just make my samsara a little bit better. Yeah? Kind of. Yeah. Anyway, Buddha said, no problem having happiness, so I just want a little better food, better sex life, better reputation, more approval from my friends, nicer place to go on holiday. And then our attachment just spirals completely wild, and we are distracted from practice. My precious tissue. You know, in this chapter it's talking about how you can be attached to anything. When you have a cold, your tissue is so dear to your heart and so dear to your nose. And what's interesting is why all the snots inside of you, you think your body's clean, and then when it comes out, you go, ugh. But it's only the stuff that comes out that is you see as dirty. The stuff that's still in you still think your body's clean. Right? Make sense? Mm. Okay. So I got an email from somebody. Every teacher's delight is to have students who really think about what they're teaching and who, you know, really think about it deeply. And so there's somebody out there in cyberspace who's really thinking about this chapter and sent in a question as well as some verses that he made up, you know, and explanation of the verses. Okay, so the question, you know, is some species are differentiated on the basis of being able to reproduce. Since some species are differentiated on the basis of being able to produce, it is appropriate for animals of the same species to be attracted to one another. Yeah? He's becoming Joe Blow here. Mm-hmm. Okay? Further, we've evolved to find advantageous traits attractive. And in order to promote and continue the species, people must have sexual intercourse. Yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it? And you can imagine people around us. I mean, I don't think it came up in Aryadeva's text like that, you know, because people weren't thinking like that specifically at that time. But, you know, it's like, oh, but yeah, we need to continue the species. Yeah, so we need to have sex in order to do that. And plus, we're biologically wired to be attracted to people of the same species, so there's nothing wrong with it. We're just doing what's natural according to our body. Sounds good, doesn't it?
Yes.
You believe it? Yes.
Yes.
I remember, this thing about it being natural for our body. I remember when we were having this discussion with His Holiness at one of the conferences of Western Buddhist teachers, and he was talking about the reason for ordination, and saying that, yeah, sex is very natural for the body. You know, we have this biological body and sexual desire comes from it. So in that way, it's natural. But he said, when you're trying to be liberated, you have to go against what is natural for your body. He was very clear about it, you know, and said, you have to really try and investigate what you consider natural for this body, and sometimes go against it because, you know, flowing with it, you can create a lot of negativity and you can get very distracted. And so he said that's the reason for monastics of keeping celibacy. Okay, we're doing something opposite to what is natural for the body because our aim is not reproducing the species, our aim is being liberated from cyclic existence. Yeah. Then I often hear many people say, at beginning courses of Dharma students, they say, but what happens if everybody got ordained in the world? Then we wouldn't have any species left. You know, human species would be defunct. Yeah, many people ask this. And so I usually say, let's worry about that problem when it happens.
That's what you told me.
Yes, that's what I told you. first of all, I don't think that is a problem that's going to happen. And second of all, why are we worrying about a problem that hasn't happened when there's so many problems that we have right now? Okay. And then this other one. So the importance of promoting and continuing our species, you know, because we feel like that's so urgent, you know, why is it? We've got to continue the human species, okay? Well, on one hand, we think we've got to continue it. On the other hand, the way we're acting today in today's society, we're acting like we don't think we have to continue it. Yeah? Because if we really, you know, believed we have to continue the human species, we would take care of the environment. And we would stop driving our cars so much, and we would recycle more. And we would, the people who are working in industry, because so much of the pollution comes from industry, you know, they would insist that their factories were environmentally sound. And people would all become vegetarian because growing cattle, raising cattle, pollutes the environment horribly. Yeah, so we say, you know, we've got to have sex to continue the species, but we're not acting as if we want to continue the species because we're not taking care of the environment that human beings need to live in. Yeah, well, that's one point. Second point is we have a whole lot of human beings right now. There's over 7 billion of us. Yeah, do we need more? Do we need more? Yeah. And look at what's happening to the planet because of overpopulation. And I've been thinking the last few years that, you know, population and birth control used to be such a big topic, you know, and now people don't talk about it very much. And I don't understand why. Somehow political something, somebody must be sensitive to it. But, you know, the population is increasing worldwide like mad, and we simply don't have the resources to continue supporting that many human beings. And yet, for whatever reason, people don't want to talk about this. Yeah? I find that very interesting. And then Of course, you know, every religion has its own position about birth control. Yeah, but when you think that the life of the human beings that are on this planet already are going to be threatened by having too many, then birth control certainly makes sense, you know, and how people do not want to allow birth control, but they don't want to support all the babies that are born either. Yeah, I mean, this is the way the U.S. government, I won't mention with which party, but how some people in Congress think. And here I'm not talking about abortion. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about just preventative birth control. Yeah. That don't want people to have that, but they don't want to support all the babies that are born either and give them a good education, make sure they have proper health care, job training, and so on. So something is not working in the way we're thinking. Okay, so those were some of my thoughts on his questions. But he also wrote some explanations himself and some verses himself, okay? So I thought I'd read a few of them, you know. So one of his verses is, common people find meaning in intercourse because it promotes humankind. I'm sure that's the reason why everybody has sex. Actually, I was talking with one monk, and he was telling me, one Western monk, and he was telling me, because he's Australian, he went to visit a friend at his friend's home when he was back in Australia. And his friend's father was really giving him a hard time for being a celibate monk. And you know, this my friend the monk said, well, kind of, you know, well, what have you done that is, you know, kind of worth it? And he said, well, I had four kids, you know, and I'm continuing the species. And my friend said, I'm sure that's what you were thinking when you were having sex with your wife. You know, we're going to do this to continue the species. Okay, so his verse says, is not cherishing that lust which destroys their goal of utmost folly. Okay, so he said, people think they have a duty as human beings to continue our species by reproducing. Okay, the idea that this goal drives the activities of all biological life is common in the discourse of evolutionary theory. Yeah. And so people do feel, you know, and actually it's one of God's commandments. You know, I was raised Jewish, and one of God's commandments is be fruitful and multiply. Yeah, so God doesn't appreciate what I'm doing. Yet the very process of reproduction causes mutations, which eventually lead to the arising of new species and the potential decline of the current ones. People may also see a need to reproduce for economic or national reasons, national interests, but sexual desire leads to all sorts of destruction, such as murder, thievery, and other things which do not promote the welfare of the species or the nation. In Singapore, they're really trying to get people to have babies, and especially to have the Chinese to have babies so that they keep the racial balance. But they only have this tiny island, you know, that's all. They try and reclaim some by putting garbage in the ocean, but, you know, how much garbage do you need to reclaim? And actually the population has doubled in the last 25 years because they've let in so many immigrants, and they're just building higher, 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 you know, because they think this is for the national benefit, because they have to have a good economy doing service, you know, the service industries. But all the food in Singapore is imported. Yeah, and a lot of the water is imported too. So what are you doing? You're increasing the population in which you have no more land, you need more food, and you need more water, which you don't have, and you have to import. And they're encouraging people still to have more babies. Yeah. And just in my experience in going back to Singapore every year, people are so much more tense now than they were 25 years ago. I mean, they really feel the population increase, and they're tense. They're much more, I hear much more complaints about different groups now than I did before, because everybody's really squished together. But it's in the national interest to have babies. You're not being very patriotic. Neither are you, the two of you. My goodness. Oh, good. Goodness sake.
Because who will fight for your country if they're not citizens, right? You need to basically people to be in the army.
Yeah, so you need to increase your national defense, so you have to have more babies born in Singapore. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to join. To join the army. To defend the country against people who won't give you the food and the water that you don't have because you've built buildings on all of your land. People ask, what do they grow in Singapore? And I say, asphalt. It's the basic crop. Okay, anyway, further, desire to have intercourse is bringing the human population to a point that the earth will no longer be able to sustain, thus undermining the goal of promoting the species. Very true, isn't it? Lust led to the initial appearance of Homo sapiens. Yet, since we are endowed with intelligence, we can use this human form to put a stop to lust. The wise know the following instincts of sexual attraction lead to our demise, not to humanity's benefit. Okay, what else did he say? So with a human form, we can accomplish a great purpose. Yet the presence of lust is not a benefit and is cherished only by foolish people. It's like thinking that sunburn is the most rewarding part of going to the beach. Many people think that because reproduction is necessary for the promotion of our species, we must therefore cherish the lust that brings people together in union. Yet there still exist species that have been around for millions of years, longer than human beings, which reproduce asexually. They have no use for partners. So how could it be reasonable to cherish lust as inherently valuable to the endurance of a species? Yeah. And then he goes on to say that, people don't really have sex to continue the species. Yeah. Because he says... Okay, for example, in homosexuality, there's mating, and it's homosexual behavior is seen in 400 species, but this, of course, doesn't produce offspring. Okay, so it's not just for reproducing the species. And also, sometimes you have, I learned a word, a zonkey. Mm-hmm. Yeah, is a cross between a zebra and a donkey. So there you have some, and neuter. Yeah. Yeah. They're sterile. Yeah, and so are mules. Yeah. So okay. And then one of the verses he wrote said, if you say our desires are conditioned biologically and ingrained in our chemistry, how could beauty come in fads? And why do even the sickly find mates? Okay, and his explanation. Some people think that we find people's bodies attractive because they possess traits most suitable for longevity and reproduction. However, attraction seems to be conditioned much more heavily by advertising and the changing social fads of the day. And that's really true, isn't it? What is considered attractive is not, something that is fixed. It is something that is constantly changing. And really conditioned by the advertising industry. And I was thinking here specifically, like in the Middle Ages, when you see all the paintings from the Middle Ages, people were very plump. Yeah? And that's because that was considered very beautiful. Yeah? And in many cultures, being fat is considered, you know, something beautiful because most of the people are starving. And so it's an indication that you're wealthy if you're overweight. Whereas in our culture, you know, it's you're kind of taught to starve yourself and be as thin as possible. And that's seen as beautiful, you know. So there's no one kind of inherent way of stating what is beautiful. You know, it really changes from culture to culture and even from time period to time period. So this, the notion is not supported by the experience of the world in any way. Everybody, regardless of their bodies, finds people who are attracted to them. Yeah? And you see this, I remember they had one story about one of the soldiers, I think he was an Iraqi vet, maybe Afghanistan, but I think Iraqi. Completely all of his limbs were off. Yeah, he lost all four limbs. And they did a story on him, and he had a girlfriend. Yeah? And so, you know, it's like everybody, regardless of their bodies, finds some people, somebody who's attracted to them. So there's no fixed state of what attraction means or of what good looking means. Okay? So Joe's blow thing about, you know, well, there's some people that are just so gorgeous you can't resist them. It doesn't make any sense. And I remember talking to one of my friends who was she was a nurse in Israel, and she was telling me that she was working with one old man who was just, his body was so decrepit, so falling apart. It was really kind of difficult for her to work with him because, you know, his body was smelly and oozing and everything like that. But his wife would come in. They had been married, I don't know, 40 or 50 years. And his wife loved him very much. And she would sit by his bed and say to my friend the nurse, saying, "Isn't he beautiful? Isn't he wonderful?" And my friend was so taken aback by this. But it does show that, you know, there's no nothing inherent in what makes somebody beautiful. So saying that we have to be attracted doesn't make any sense. Okay, let's go back to Aryadeva. Okay, so we're on verse 64. So Aryadeva says, "Blinded by desire, they do not see sensuality's faults, like a leper scratching. Those free from desire see the infatuated as suffering like the leper." Okay, so a leper, I've known many lepers in Dharamsala. There were resident lepers. You know, you got to know the lepers because they lived there all year round. There were some new people that came for teachings, but there were year-round lepers that you just got to know. And, you know, they scratch, yeah, because it gives a little bit of pleasure. But what happens is the scratching makes the disease worse. And it causes bleeding, it causes the wounds to ooze. Okay? So it's kind of like drinking salt water to quench your thirst. It gives you a little bit of temporary pleasure, but in the end it makes it worse. Okay, so that's what Aryadeva is saying here. So similarly, those whose eye of wisdom is blind, is blinded by desire, don't see the faults of sensuality. Yeah? And they don't see that indulging in sensuality is actually making their situation in samsara worse, not better, because of the negative karma you create. And he said, since the Aryas who are free from the itch of desire See, the infatuated is suffering like the leper. Desire can't be pleasurable. So are you beings who are free from this kind of desire? Look upon people who are full of lust and have compassion for them, you know, because of the suffering they're undergoing due to their attachment to sensuality. And if you look around, people get themselves in the most amazing jams because of attachment to sex, don't they? You know, an attachment to the objects of the senses in general, but especially to sex. People get in the most amazing dysfunctional relationships that are so harmful, that make them totally miserable. Sometimes they're even abused, you know, not only emotionally, but also physically by their partner. But the force of the attachment makes it so difficult for them to separate, even though they're not happy in the relationship. Yeah, and we see this all the time. And people undergo who knows what to try and please the object of their desire. Yeah? So we try and be what we think they think we should be. You know, we put up with incredible amount of nonsense in the other person because we want to stay with them because we're so attracted to them. Yeah? So they may cheat on us, they may lie to us, they may do amazing things, but we put up with it because we, you know, are hooked in. Yeah. They may limit our freedom, they may yell at us, deprecate us, throw things at us, curse us, belittle us, make us lose our own self-confidence, but we still stay because of this attachment. Foolish, isn't it? Foolish. And we see this all the time, and we've probably been in relationships like that. Okay, verse 65.
I was reading only a little bit in Vishuddhapya's commentary. Mm-hmm. And he was bringing up the point that there was this point of living in celibacy and to this...
A point of
living in celibacy, and he was example here with the leper, sick person.
The leper, yeah.
That when you how is it promote sexuality again and again, and you come together again and again, it's like scratching your skin again and again. But when you take the rules, or when you live in celibacy, then you interrupt the scratching, and it will get better from time over time.
Right. So, yeah. 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 So, so you're saying that Geshe Thapke said basically what I said too, that you scratch it,
yeah,
and that makes it worse. Yeah. But when you stop scratching, after a while, the itch goes away,
yeah,
and it gets better over time.
Yeah. I found it quite interesting in relationship to the sexuality, because we think we are so dependent on that and it's not interruptible.
Yeah.
So, and it gets not worse, but when you look at in this context.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, the longer you're celibate, you know, if you're practicing well, it, you know, the easier it becomes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you just kind of get used to it after a while. And that's the one good thing about growing old, is your sexual desire goes down, and then it's just kind of like, I'm too old for that anyway. You know? Been there, done that. Don't need that again. You look crestfallen.
The word, but relationship is trouble,
isn't it?
It is. It's so complicated.
Yeah. Very complicated. Yeah. And I know people don't like to hear this, and people will watch this video and go, ooh, she's so anti-sex, she's so anti-relationship, ooh, this nun, ooh. You know. But I just ask a simple question. Have you ever had an easy relationship? Do you know anybody who's had an easy relationship? I just ask the question, that's all. And look in your own experience.
Oh, why can't you have a relationship and have only one sexual contact? And that's not the case either.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, so the question, why can't you just have a relationship and you only have sex once?
You need to reproduct yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if sex were ultimately fulfilling, having it once would fulfill you. Wouldn't it? There wouldn't be any need to do it again and again and again. Because once would be enough. Yeah. Okay, verse 65. During a famine, the destitute, tormented by hunger, bear what occurs. This is how all the infatuated behave when they are with people they're attracted to. Okay, so during a famine, those tormented by hunger will bear being insulted 100 times by a merciless rich person in the hope that he will later give them a little bit. Yeah, and so the behavior of an infatuated person is just like that. This is what I was just saying before, that, you know, what we put up with because we're so attached and infatuated with somebody. So therefore, how can that be pleasure? If you put up with all this painful stuff, how can it be pleasurable? Verse 66, through ignorance, one may be attached even to one's privy. I think privy is a polite word for toilet. Okay, anyone infatuated with somebody, you know, they're attracted to, will be jealous of others. So this is said in response. Joe Blow is piping up again here. And he says there is real pleasure from another person because those who are attached to the pleasure from them are jealous of others. Okay, you see his object? So it is what he's saying, that because somebody is jealous of other people who look at the person that they're attached to, then there must be real pleasure from having sex with that person because other people want it too and they're jealous of you. Okay, and Gyalsabje says, through arrogance, one may be attached even to one's toilet. Okay, in other words, your argument doesn't work. Okay, because a rich man who is arrogant about his wealth may be very possessive about his toilet and forbid others to use it. Just as somebody who's very attached to another person, you know, they don't want anybody else to come near them. They're jealous of anybody else. Similarly, anyone infatuated with a particular person is seen to be baselessly jealous of others. It's like being so attached to your toilet that you don't want anybody else coming near it. And the other person's body is like a toilet. You know. And again, when all the pee and poo is inside that person, you look at them and you say, wow, you know, how good looking they are. But when the pee and poo come out, you go, you know, stinky, flush the toilet and get it away. But when it's inside that person, you still want to hug and kiss that person. Does that make sense? Okay, verse 67. Oh, so Joe Blow again says, though bodies are unclean, desire is reasonable because the bodies are the source of pleasure. So he just keeps finding one way after another. Okay, they're unclean, but they're still the source of pleasure. So, you know, that doesn't make it so bad. So Gyalsabje says, it is reasonable for confusion and anger about the unclean to occur. It is not at all reasonable for desire to occur. So what he's saying here is, you know, when you realize that a body is unclean, then having desire for it is inappropriate, okay? When you step in excrement without noticing it, it's feasible that confusion could occur and that the offensive smell could give rise to anger. Yeah. So you could be confused about if you step in a pile of caca, you know. And you could get angry about the bad smell. But you're never going to be attached to that experience. Okay? So, but it's not unreasonable for incongruous desire to occur. In other words, you know, so the idea here is we're confused about the nature of the body because we decorate it with ornaments and perfumes and beautiful cloth and everything like that. So having confusion about the body, you know, that's understandable. And having some, you know, if the person farts or, you know, goes to the bathroom or whatever, or doesn't put on deodorant, you know, you could get angry at the smell. But desire is never appropriate because of the body's unclean nature. You know, when you realize the body is unclean, how can you still say that desire is appropriate? Because it brings pleasurable. It brings pleasure. Okay? So, Kyaltsub Jay says, thus desire for another's body is unreasonable. It's like stepping in excrement at night. Very graphic, isn't it? Verse 68. If, except to some people, a pot of filth is objectionable, why would one not think objectionable that from which the filth comes? So if you find a pot of poo stinky and objectionable, why wouldn't you find the human body that created it objectionable? Okay? So Kelsip Jay says, when everybody except people who are not in their right mind find a pot full of vomit or, you know, poo, disgusting, why would a sensible person not see the body from which that pit filth came also as disgusting? Okay. It's like some lustful person who desires another person but finds that person objectionable because they see them carrying a pot of vomit. So imagine this. Okay, you're walking down the street. This very attractive person is coming towards you the other way. Yeah, you go, oh, who is that? Wow, I want to flirt with that person. And then you notice that they're carrying a big bucket of vomit. Yeah, and you go, ooh. But do you, and you might be repulsed, but do you think that vomit came out of that very attractive person?
No.
You would never think that, would you? And even if you saw that really handsome guy throwing up, you know, it was like, let's just clear away the vomit, and he's still handsome. But where did that vomit come from? Okay? So the childish don't see anything wrong with filth while it's in the body, but think of it as filth when it leaves the body. That's why we're called the childish, you know? That's what childish beings do. They can't think clearly. 69. Okay, Joe Blow again. He says, but the body of people, you know, we're attracted to must be clean because people regard them as clean. You know, so if people think they're clean, they must be clean. Okay, clean things are looked upon as the most worthless of all. What intelligent person would say that it is clean? Okay, so it's absurd for any intelligent person to think that the body is clean by nature. Clean things like perfume, flowers, ornaments, food, all these things become worthless because of having been in contact with the body. So that's what it says when it says clean things are looked down upon as the most worthless of all after they've been in contact with the body. Yeah? And we really see that, you know. Somebody wears some clothes, you don't want to put on the clothes somebody else wore.
I have to pack my things.
You know? This person got disgusted with me. The person on the telephone hung up for those people who are watching. Okay, so, you know, anything that we put on the body or whatever, we use to disguise its uncleanliness. But the body makes that thing unclean. So I was saying, like, if somebody else has been, you know, if one of the guys out there has been wearing something for a few days and they've been sweating in it and everything, would you want to put it on? No, thank you. We have to wash it first. If somebody uses a towel, a bath towel, we won't even use it because their body, even though they came out of the shower spanking clean, because their body came in contact with that bath towel, we don't want to use the towel. And even if they slept in some sheets, you know, after taking a bath, we don't want to sleep in those same sheets because their body touched it. Okay? So just contacting the body, we, you know, we think makes something dirty. Okay. So he's so just, you know, due to contact with the body, things become, you know, considered as dirty. Just as the sweet water of the Ganges becomes saline upon meeting the ocean. Yeah. Okay, oh, this is a good verse. So Joe Blow again says, the body is clean because we see people taking pride in it. This is, you know, our friends in the audience. We see people, you know, us too. Yeah, we're not free from, you know, oh, look at my body, it's so attractive. You know, these robes make it so good looking, so flattering to my figure, don't you think? You know, I want to make sure I look really good and, you know, keep my collar and, yeah. Okay. So, you know, so the body is clean because we see people taking pride in it. And Aryadeva says, whoever has lived in a privy and without it would not have survived. In such a dung worm, arrogance arises only through stupidity. Okay, so whatever is born from the womb has lived in it, okay? And the womb is located between the stomach and the intestines. Yeah, so living in the womb is like living in a toilet. You know, you're right there in the middle of all the digested food, okay? And you know, it's interesting how we think birth is beautiful and everything like that, and this baby comes out and everybody's so happy. But the baby's been attached to the placenta. Have you ever seen a placenta? Ew. You know? Just snuggled up to that. We're in the womb, but we are snuggled up to the placenta, aren't we? Really kind of disgusting. So it's so like a dung worm, okay, like a worm that lives in dung. You know, in India, there, you know, there's the cow dung is all over the place, okay? There's worms living in it. So like a dung worm, it has been nurtured by excremental juices without which it wouldn't have survived. That's our body. So pride, thinking of that as clean, arises only through stupidity. Okay, it's absurd to be proud of that. So the story that they tell, it's like somebody, okay, who was running away from an enemy, and they fell inside a cesspool, and they had to live in that cesspit for a long time until it was okay for them to escape, get out and escape. But later, after they get out and escape, when a beggar's clothing touched them, they go, "Ooh, your vile clothing has made me dirty." So it's like us who lived in the cesspool inside the womb, and yet when we come out, you know, somebody's dirty clothes or something, whatever, we go, "Ooh, you made my body dirty." But, you know, where did this body come from? Where did it originate and grow? So it's like that. Okay. So then Job Lowe says, "The body is clean since washing removes dirt from it." So it must be clean. You just wash the dirt off. No problem. So Aryadeva says, "No means whatsoever will purify the inside of the body. The efforts you make towards the outside do not match those made towards the inside." Okay, so ritual ablution and washing don't cleanse the inside of your body. Yeah, you can wash the outside of your body all you want and think that that is making the body clean, but, you know, are you going to wash your intestines to make them clean? You know, wash your liver and make it clean. Yeah, wash your heart, or maybe your lungs, your larynx, yeah, your kidneys, you know, make them all clean. You know, is that going to happen? Yeah, even if you could wash your internal organs, would that make them clean? In fact, what happens if you washed all the shit inside you? Is that going to make it clean? Yeah? Okay, so Aryadeva is saying, why make effort to clean what by nature is unclean? You think that what leaves the body is filthy, but what remains in it is clean. If you think the filth that leaves the body can't be clean because it's dirty by nature, then the same applies to the filth that's inside the body. Okay, you don't make as much effort to clean the filth that has left your body as you make to clean the outside of your body. Yeah, but it would be reasonable to do so because both are filthy by nature. So if you're going to clean the outside of your body thinking that that's going to make it clean, then you might as well clean the inside of your body, and you might as well clean your excrement after it comes out also.
You make it even more unclean if you're smoking and drinking this wine, and because this has a special effect on your body, on your digestion, and your lungs are getting filthy with these tears.
Oh, okay, yeah. So you're saying when you smoke, then you're even making the inside of your body more unclean.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So then Job Lowe says, since ascetic sages don't give up others' bodies, craving for them isn't something to abandon. So, you know, all these ascetic wanderers who are supposed to be, you know, have higher spiritual realizations, the time of India, you know, ancient India is full of these people. So they haven't given up desire for other people's bodies. So, you know, craving for them isn't something to abandon. So why should it be something for me to abandon? Aryadeva says, if, like leprosy, being full of urine were not common to all, those full of urine, just like the lepers, would be shunned by everyone. In other words, although people are all full of urine, you know, the sages don't give them up because they too have urine inside of them. Okay. So when everybody has urine inside of them, then we don't think anything is abnormal or particularly dirty. Yeah, if only some people had urine, the ones who didn't then would see them as dirty. Okay, so it's kind of like, Yeah, just as you know, since not everybody is a leper, then we stay away from them. Yeah, if everybody were a leper, nobody would care at all about it. Okay, so others aren't these ascetics don't avoid others because they're clean, but because everybody's alike and having a body that's full of pee and poo. Okay. We have a few minutes for questions or comments. Yeah.
I'm just about the untouchables in India. Why do some classes in India see them as unclean, so that they are not even should get touched by?
Yeah. So what about the untouchable mm-hmm. class in India? Yeah, that is based on, I think that initiated with the Brahman idea that everybody was created from Brahma, from different parts of the body of Brahma. And so the Brahmins were created from the head, and then, you know, different castes were created from different parts of the body. And the untouchables, they say, were created, I don't know from, but it must be some disgusting part of the body. Yeah? And so they treat them like that. And it's, you know, that kind of caste has not gone away in India, unfortunately. Yeah, Gandhi certainly was against it, but, you know, it takes much more than that to make it disappear. Other questions or comments?
I was quite astonished since the last week
mm-hmm.
when I was realizing how our ignorance and our oscillations, that I was wondering the last week, why if sometimes we are attached to somebody that is clear that is suffering, or this kind of relationships that is clear that has not happiness in any way or in any side, because there is violence, because there is drugs, because there is so many things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was astonished, and now that I listen to you, I am astonished about how is this confusion that we even think that what is attached, that causes us attached or desire, should be something interesting, beautiful, or pleasurable. When sometimes it's even...
It's not, yeah.
Something we know that is painful. And Venerable Sutta was telling in one motivation, one question that for me was interesting. She said, are you attached to the pain? And immediately the answer in my mind was, of course not. Anybody mm-hmm. wants to be attached to the pain. But actually we are attached so many times to the pain that many things that are causing us yeah. pain, and many things that we can see that there is not pleasure, there is not something beautiful, and even though we are attached to that.
Yeah.
So I was wondering how...
Yeah, okay, so you're saying that you've been thinking about the fact that we're attached to so many things that actually cause us so much suffering. For example, people staying in relationships where they're so unhappy, you know, and yet they can't separate from that person out of attachment. And, you know, how then the question comes, are we attached to the pain? And I would say, no, we're not attached to the pain. Nobody likes pain. But we are attached to the situation or the person that causes the pain. Because somehow, in our ignorance, we think that the pain is just something temporary, it's an accident, that actually that person in that situation is really going to make us happy. You know, that if we stick it out, if we stay there long enough, yeah, that somehow everything's going to change and that person, you know, or that relationship, that situation will turn into something that will make us happy. So it's kind of like the rats pecking, you know, on the pecker, thinking that someday, you know, they maybe got one grain at the beginning, So they keep pecking, waiting for another grain to come. Or it's like people playing the shot machines in Vegas. You know, there's the hope that, you know, I'm going to get this flood of quarters coming out. If I just do it long enough, certainly this is going to make me happy. Yeah? So we put up with a lot of misery, actually, for situations that usually don't turn around like that. Yeah? Yeah?
I think the other thing that can happen is if you grew up with pain and that's all you know,
right,
then there isn't any place in your mind to think that it would be anything different.
Right.
So this is how it's kind of supposed to be.
Yeah. So if you grew up in a family where there's lots of pain, if your parents had a relationship that was not very healthy, then your natural way of thinking is this is what's normal, and this is what's acceptable, and this is how everybody's relationship is. So you don't leave because you don't see that there could be an alternative. Yeah? So you just stay in that situation because that's what you're used to, what you grew up with. It's very sad, isn't it?
Better this than nothing.
Yeah. Or thinking, yeah, better this than nothing. Yeah. If I'm not with this person, then I'll be really alone. Yeah. Yeah. And so this incredible fear of loneliness. Whereas people could look at the situation of being alone and think, wow, freedom. You know? I can do so much being alone. I can use my creativity. I can think for myself. I can travel. There's so much possibility. But people have so much fear of being alone that, like you said, better this than nothing. Yeah. And also how society tends to look at people who aren't in relationships. Like, what's wrong with you? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking it's not just pain, but we're so habituated to low-grade pleasure. And we don't... I mean, it took me so... When the first time I went on a retreat and I experienced some quiet, I was so shocked to see that was what happiness could feel like.
Yeah.
Even I'm just so habituated to being high-strung or getting an adrenaline rush, and that was what I imagined was pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah. So being quite accustomed to low-grade pleasure... Then again, not realizing that there's an alternative. And the example here is you're so used to being frenzied and propelled by your adrenaline that when you first went on retreat and got peaceful, it was like, oh, I never even realized this was possible. Yeah.
It comes back to your motivation in the beginning, like when you think it was through again and again, and you really realize how much time you're spending with covering actually the reality. From the morning when you get up until the evening when you're with your partner, how much you're spending your time to cover your body up, to make your partner nice, whatever, you have expectations, you want to have kind of theater stage. And that takes so much energy.
Yeah. So you're saying how much energy it takes from morning till evening to kind of cover the reality of what the body is, you know, and to make yourself attractive to your partner, to make your partner look attractive to you. You know, turn on the bathroom fan, honey. But it's true, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. So pondering this will keep us busy for the next week. And we are coming to the end of the third chapter, and so then we'll go on to the fourth chapter, which is about selflessness, but particularly about a gross form of self-grasping, that is conceit or arrogance, and so how to diminish that. Yeah. Okay, good. Spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of the sun's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase. Om Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, and by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Travasti Abbey in the West Flourish.